This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We will visit with Associated Press Capitol correspondent Melinda DeLotte and Kevin Fry, the WAFB Capitol reporter. They will respond to Governor Edwards' doomsday budget. That's the headline in The Advocate today. TOPS and health care funding would be hit hard if the fiscal cliff becomes a reality. Longtime activist Frances Moore LePay will comment on her book, Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning and Connection for the America We Want. She is, of course, a longtime activist and has been around for five decades and believes that democracy is in peril in our country. Veteran Baton Rouge singer and musician Luther Kent will recall John Fred, who was at the top of the Billboard charts 50 years ago with Judy in Disguise. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Coming in just a bit, we'll hear from Kevin Fry of WAFB and Melinda DeLotte from the Associated Press regarding the fiscal cliff. Governor John Bel Edwards delivered his doomsday budget yesterday, a not-so-pretty picture that he painted that would be reality, he says, if we don't find about $1 billion in new money or find a way to renew the penny sales tax, something he does not want to do, and the legislature appears not willing to do either. So something has to give, and we'll talk about it with two people who cover the Capitol with earnest. As we mentioned yesterday, this week marks the 50th anniversary. That's half a century since Baton Rouge's John Fred Gourier was at the top of the Billboard charts with Judy in Disguise. And in just a moment, we're going to hear from his good friend Luther Kent, who's still going strong. But John Fred left quite a mark on the community he loved. He was a big part of this community of Baton Rouge and died in 2005 at the age of 63, much too young, fought kidney disease. But in 1968, when he was a young lad of 26, he was at the top of the world and at the top of the charts with this memorable song. Ago today at the top of the charts with Judy in Disguise, and a man who knew him well, a great musician and singer in his own right, Big Luther Kent is with us, and it's hard to believe it's been a half century, Luther.
Wow, you know, it's amazing. I say this all the time, where did the years go? I don't understand, but I tell you, John was a very, very dear friend. He was actually the first guy that ever put me on stage. We became extremely good friends and remained friends until his death. And had a lot of good times with him over the years. I really did.
It's hard to believe he's been dead almost 13 years. He was only 63 when he died. That doesn't sound that old today.
No, it doesn't. And I can't believe you telling me it's been 13 years, because it really doesn't seem like that long.
Well, he had a major time on the big stage. He was certainly one of the most famous men in America in 1968. And it's amazing how many accomplished artists never have a number one song. Creedence Clearwater Revival, for example, never had a number one. But John Fred did, and he wrote it.
And Andrew Bernard wrote it.
Yeah, and it's an unusual song and somewhat tongue-in-cheek.
Well, you know, it also went number one in several different countries in Europe. It was a very, very big record, and it was a unique-sounding record, and I think that had a little something to do with it, because it was so unique, you know?
Yeah, well, the lyrics don't make a whole lot of sense, and obviously it was a takeoff on Lucy and the Sky with Diamonds. Keep a-wearing your bracelets and your new rah-rahs and cross your heart, yeah, with your living bra. Chimney sweep sparrow with guys, Judy in disguise with glasses. That's not the kind of lyrics that you normally hear, but John Fred had a vivid imagination, and Luther, you're a bit younger than he was, and certainly younger than Johnny Rivers, who was a year younger than John Fred. But imagine, those two guys grew up here at the same time in Baton Rouge.
That's right. John Fred grew up right across the street from Baton Rouge High on Eugene Street.
And Johnny Rivers, then Johnny Ramostella, grew up on Convention Street, not too far away. And I would imagine for the kids who were in town at that time in life, in the mid to late 60s, these guys certainly had an impact on their lives.
Well, I'll tell you, I used to go, when I first moved to Baton Rouge, it was 1960, and I used to go religiously to the CYO centers every Friday night. They would have really great artists playing there all the time. And that was actually the first place that I saw John Fred. And Harold Cowart was playing with him. Harold was a bass player. Harold's mother actually taught me math in junior high. And later on, Harold and I wound up being in a group together called Cold Grits in 1970. And that was actually the first time that I'd heard John Fred sing. And the first time I sang with him was at a place, I'm showing my age now, called Thunderbird Beach.
Wow. Thunderbird Beach, and in what year would that have been?
Wow. Okay, let's see. 48, 58, 63, maybe?
Wow. And you were born in 1948, so you were a very young man.
Correct. I was about 13, 14 years old, and I knew Harold through his mother because she taught me math, and I couldn't drive. I didn't have a driver's license. I was too young, and Harold came and picked me up one day and said, "You want to go to Thunderbird Beach and hear the band?" I said, "Sure." And that's when I met John, and he asked me if I'd like to sit in that day. And I said, "Well, sure." You know, I was elated, man. I couldn't believe it. So that's kind of how we became friends, and we remained friends for 50 years, and very good friends. I mean, we used to talk all the time. We used to go to lunch together all the time. And when I was in the Greek Fountains, every Christmas we would do a two-week tour, like of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. And it would be John Fred and the Playboys and the Greek Fountains. And we would book about, I don't know, 10, 11, 12 dates through that two-week period. And both acts would play together back-to-back on all of these dates. And we had a tremendous time. We really did.
Well, John Fred was a tall man, a striking fellow, and he was a basketball star. And legend has it that when John Fred and the Playboys had their first hit, Shirley, he couldn't appear on the American Bandstand because he had to play in a basketball game.
That's a true story. And Dick Clark, being the guy that he was, understood that John was playing on a championship team, and he rescheduled for John to come and appear on American Bandstand.
Well, he was a man of great generosity and carried his fame well, and he never had another hit like Judy in Disguise, but he played almost up to the end of his life.
He did, and every summer he and I would perform together for the 4th of July event down on the river in Baton Rouge, and we did it up until a few years before he died because it would be so hot in July. I remember the last time we did it together, he kind of looked at me, and I looked at him, and I said, "I think this is the last time, John. I can't take the heat anymore, you know?" But, like I said, we performed together quite a lot over the years and remained friends up until his death.
And you started, as mentioned, when you were a teenager, and when I say a teenager, a young teenager.
Right. I signed with Montel Records when I was 15 years old, and that kind of opened the doors for me. Back then, if you could get a 45 out, then it would help you to actually, you know, get bookings. So that's kind of how I broke into the business. And I've been doing it ever since for 53 years.
And you've performed with Pete Fountain and Alan Toussaint?
Yeah, Pete and I recorded together. Alan and I recorded together in 1974. I had the honor of being asked to be the lead singer with Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And I've been very blessed to be able to have performed with so many great musicians over my career.
But John Fred, he not only was a great musician, but he was a local guy and a good friend.
Yes, yes, for many years. Mm-hmm.
People may not know it, but he battled kidney disease for many, many years.
Yeah, he was on dialysis for quite a while.
And did it gallantly.
Yeah, he did.
And I know his beautiful bride, Sandra, is listening. And they met a little later in life, and now one of his sons is married to Sandra's daughter.
Right. You know, it's amazing how that all took place. And Sandra and I have remained friends over the years. She's a very sweet lady. Every now and then we'll get together and have dinner. And she's just a very, very sweet gal, man. She really is.
Thank you, Luther Kent. And certainly a fine gentleman, Luther Kent, who's still going strong himself. And he remembered with great fondness John Fred Gourier, who was at the top of the charts for 2 weeks, January 1968, with Judy in Disguise, supplanting the Beatles in Hello, Goodbye. Lemon Pipers and the Green Tambourine, that came next. And we're next with Kevin Fry and Melinda DeLotte right here on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Sasha Cabanshaw is producing today. Your number is 877-217-5757. Locally, in Baton Rouge, it's 297-5633, and you can always send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. We're joined by Melinda DeLotte, who covers the Capitol for the Associated Press and has for a few years, and Kevin Fry from WAFB, who yesterday was also on hand when Governor John Bel Edwards unveiled a doomsday budget. The budget would gut the popular TOPS program. It would also have steep cuts to health care, mental health programs, and eliminate funding for some local government services. And this is something the governor and the legislature are trying to avert, and they hopefully will find a way between now and the 30th of June, which is the deadline, with the fiscal year ending on that date. 877-217-5757. Let's start with you, Kevin. What's your take on what happened yesterday?
Well, this was we have been leading up to this for several months now, and the governor had been kind of previewing his doomsday budget, or his worst-case scenario budget, if you will. This takes into account that $1 billion shortfall projected for next year when several temporary taxes fall off the books, the most noteworthy being the 1 cent increase to the sales tax that was enacted 2 years ago, I believe, when they were trying to Band-Aid and fix the budget at that point. So this was something that the governor prefaced multiple times. This is something that he does not want to see enacted. He's said that several times in the past. He said it several times yesterday. And so he is asking lawmakers to fill in this budget. Now, the common critique is that this is simply fear-mongering and that this is simply just trying to get lawmakers to act. Whether or not this will change any minds as a result of these drastic cuts to TOPS and other programs is yet to be seen. But I believe it was Jay Darden yesterday said they may be scary. It's not a scare tactic, it's just scary.
Well, that's the Commissioner of Administration who's been down this block a time or two on several sides of the aisle. And Melinda DeLotte is with us. She's covered the Capitol for many years. We've heard these doomsday scenarios before, Melinda, but is this one for real?
Well, I mean, they definitely are losing $1 billion in state general fund revenue, and there is only a small amount of discretionary money that they can cut from. So yes, you're right that in previous years we've heard a lot of talk about the possibility of very deep budget cuts and closure of services and programs that people rely on. And in those years, what they've done is during the Jindal administration, they kind of raided trust funds and they swept other funds and they used a lot of patchwork money to stop those kind of things from happening. And in the Edwards administration, they've passed some taxes to stop those things from happening the first couple of years. So the question is, will they do it again?
Kevin and Melinda, it appears that there is division, no surprise, between the Democratic governor and some Republicans in the legislature, principally Sharon Hewitt, who may very well be running against John Bel Edwards in next year. It was quite tense at one point between those two.
Right. And Sharon Hewitt was arguing that, look, I cannot see where the governor's claim that he has cut, I believe his figure is $600 million from the budget since taking office. And Sharon Hewitt is asking essentially, where is this money? I can't find it in the data that you're showing me. And so their exchange went something to the point of where the governor said to her, and I'm looking up my quote here, I can explain it to you. I can't understand it for you, to which she replied that that's insulting. And that was perhaps the high water mark in terms of the interaction between the governor and lawmakers yesterday. But there were some, at moments, kind of tense or at least edgy, shall we say, exchanges, not just from lawmakers, but from the governor himself.
Well, has $600 million been cut from the general fund, Melinda?
Well, I mean, that's kind of a good question. And if you look at the list that the governor's office provides, they do have things that have been cut, but some of them were cut once and then restored later, or they were cut from state general fund, but perhaps they were filled with other revenue sources that the agencies had available to them. So Senator Hewitt's point was sort of broader in the idea of, have we stopped providing certain services, or are there programs that we have cut? And a lot of Republicans have talked about that idea of, are we actually doing less than we were doing 2 years ago, or are we just shuffling money that is available to fill gaps? And you know, should this be the size government that we have? Can the state afford this size government? And that's just the ongoing philosophical dispute that a lot of Republicans and the governor have a difference on.
And it's already emerging, as we saw yesterday. I mean, we have been leading up to this, but now we are kind of getting back into the similar routine that we have seen before, which is the cuts or increased taxes. Mm-hmm. Have we trimmed down spending enough?
The governor wanted to get this done as far as some kind of budget agreement on the 19th of January. Well, we're at the 23rd of January. Does that mean there will be no special session?
What did you put it at yesterday, Melinda, 50-50?
I'm not supposed to prognosticate. I will say that I think one thing that is worth noting is, while there are some Republicans who think that they don't need to do anything to replace the expiring taxes and that government can just live with $1 billion less than state general fund, they are a minority in that group. A lot of Republicans feel some money has to be raised, that some of those expiring taxes have to be replaced in some fashion. It's just a question of which tax types can they agree on and what number do they want to see replaced? Is it the full billion? Is it somewhere less than that? And can they reach an agreement with the governor? He calls it an agreement in principle before February 15th, which is when arguably a special session would need to start, just timetable wise. And the thing that is worth noting, and one of the Democratic senators pointed out yesterday, is, you know, the legislators keep talking about, well, the governor's plan, we have problems with the governor's plan, he hasn't provided enough information, we don't have financial estimates. But the legislators technically could call themselves into session. They don't regularly do it, but if they had problems with the way the governor is approaching it, in theory, they could call themselves into session and come up with their own plan and handle it that way. That's just not historically how Louisiana tends to function. So mm-hmm. You haven't seen a lot of that.
And taxes need two-thirds support. So is it going to be hard to get 70 votes in the House and 26 in the Senate no matter what is proposed?
Well, and yesterday I was speaking with House Appropriations Chair Cameron Henry, and his argument going into all this, he's one of the folks that is kind of adamantly or at least very much skeptical of why we would need a special session, mm-hmm. at least right now. And he was kind of going back and forth with me as I was asking him questions about he doesn't believe that there should be backroom dealing or at least vote counting before we go into a special session, because he says otherwise, why do we even have a legislative process? Now, it's noteworthy that at any point during any session, people count votes before they bring a bill into a committee or onto the floor, because why bring up something if it's automatically going to die unless you're kind of living on principle? And so that is kind of his argument, that there shouldn't be these backroom dealings. That's one of his arguments, I guess you could say. And so that he is one of the, I think, hardliners in terms of being skeptical there. I think there is some general consensus amongst Democrats and Republicans in the middle that something needs to be done. It's just a matter of whether or not they will pull the trigger and do it.
Melinda, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say to that point, I mean, one of the things that most of the Republican leadership of the House seems to agree with, Cameron Henry might be the exception to this, but right. Lance Harris, who is the House Republican delegation leader, and House Speaker Taylor Barra, who is a Republican, they both favor having a special session in February and dealing with the problem now. Because if they go into the regular session that starts in March without having replace some of the expiring revenue, there is this assumption that they won't have enough votes to pass a budget that would cut $1 billion, that legislators wouldn't want their name on some of those types of cuts that they would have to make. And so then it could just postpone everything into a special session that would come after the regular in June, and the new fiscal year starts on July 1st. So that'd be pushing it real close. So you see the Republican leadership of the House generally in favor of some sort of session in February. It's just a question of can they come to enough of an agreement that the governor thinks that he will be successful in getting votes for something.
Sorry, Melinda. And there's a practical implication, rather, that Representative Katrina Jackson pointed out yesterday. Others have pointed out, the head of the Southern University has pointed out, that if you wait until then, especially when it comes to college students who are making their decisions on what to do, whether or not to go to school, pick a university, if TOPS will be there, if they don't know until June, that's a little late to make a decision.
877-217-5757 is your number. We'll spend a few more minutes with Kevin Fry from WAFB and Melinda Delotte from the Associated Press discussing the budget scenario that's not so rosy right now at the Capitol. And we'll be back after this pause for the news with Karen Henderson on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number again is 877-217-5757. You can send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. Melinda Delotte from the Associated Press and Kevin Fry from WAFB, who both cover the Capitol with Ernest, are in-house for a little while longer. And if you have something on your mind, please present it to Melinda and Kevin. Here is a question from Scott in Baton Rouge. Why is more not mentioned about the hundreds of millions of dollars worth of tax expenditures, subsidies that the state pays out each year? Didn't corporations pay net zero state taxes a year or two ago? Melinda?
Well, I think when people use the term taxes, they are including the various tax breaks, the tax exemptions, deductions, rebates, all of those kinds of things. Those are clearly part of the discussion. Some people have different words that they use to explain those, but when the term taxes is broadly used in the Capitol, that tends to include those programs as being part of the consideration of should they be phased back, should they be removed, those kind of things. In fact, Representative Lance Harris, the Republican House leader, yesterday was talking about possibilities of scaling back the film tax break program as a way to generate additional money for the state. So that is clearly all part of the ongoing conversation about taxes.
It's an all-encompassing discussion, Kevin, but it's getting close to the finish line, 5 months and 7 days away, and time will go quickly. And if something is not done between now and the 30th of June, then this doomsday scenario could happen.
Well, I mean, the doomsday scenario could happen with the asterisk that the House and the Senate still get to move things around. So chances are this will not look at any, the actual end result if $1 billion were not found would look like this. It's also worth noting that yesterday the governor pointed out that, look, you've known about this for 2 years now and we're still worrying about this. We're still dealing with this. And you could feel some exasperation from some of the lawmakers themselves. Rick Edmonds from here in Baton Rouge was at one point going off that he's like, I can't understand how anyone would want to keep dealing with this year in and year out. But the question is, will they actually get into the end zone and actually come up with some sort of way of making a more predictable, stable budget environment as opposed to some more temporary measures, including the sales tax that they kind of used to patch things up.
And TOPS appears to be continually on the chopping block. It's a source of discussion every year or so. Melinda?
It absolutely is. Some of that is purely because it is one of the larger places for discretionary funding where the state isn't locked in by a constitutional mandate or a court judgment or the long list of things that they are required to do under various federal and state laws. TOPS is just one of those areas. That the price tag of the program is growing. It's nearing $300 million. And of that, you know, $230 to $240 million of it is discretionary funding. So it's just a big target all the time.
And Kevin, I don't think that's going to change unless some new money is found.
No, there are efforts right now for some law, or at least one lawmaker is proposing trying to set aside a certain tax. I believe it's an increase to the sales tax by a quarter of a penny or a half a penny to just set that aside specifically for TOPS so they don't go through this every single year. Ironically, TOPS is the sacred cow at the Capitol, but it always is kind of the punching bag and the sore spot whenever they come to budget negotiations.
And HB writes about Senator Kennedy, former Treasurer Kennedy, his suggestion that the budget could be solved, the issues could be solved by cutting consulting contracts. So we've heard this a time or two, Melinda, and Senator Kennedy has not stepped away from this. He continues to say that we've got enough money, we just don't spend it correctly.
He has indeed continued to say that, and I think we've seen some House Republicans in particular take some of his ideas and try to translate them into the budget negotiation, and you haven't seen some of it get very far. The Edwards administration says it has cut some contracts. I think the figure they've used is around $25 million that has been saved from reductions in contracts. But what you get at when you get at some of these things is if you look at the – we do have billions of dollars in contracts as a state, but if you look at where the lion's share of the contracts are, it's in the Medicaid program, and it's not consulting work. It's for the management of the health care services that people get. So we have managed care organizations that get billions of dollars in payments to pay doctors and hospitals and those sort of healthcare providers to give services. So the lion's share of the contracts, a lot of them were enacted during Bobby Jindal's administration when he privatized a lot of the state's programs. And so now a lot of those contracts are for actual services that get provided. And so when people start to dig into them, when legislators start to look at them, they run into problems of contractual obligations, and they also run into problems of do they want to cut a service tied to that contract.
This could be a prelude to next year's governor's election. It looks like Senator Kennedy may very well be running, and he has a different idea about the budget in Baton Rouge, although he did vote to lift the debt ceiling in Washington. But Kevin Frey, it would be quite a race between Governor Edwards and Senator Kennedy.
Well, we're starting to see the John Kennedy angle, and he certainly is getting plenty of national press as well. I know I saw him on the CBS morning show this morning quoting about the shutdown. And he and there are other people that are kind of lining up, as we saw yesterday with Sharon Hewitt, are starting to kind of potentially align themselves in a way to go after the governor and also start this race a year and a half out from the election day itself.
Melinda, it would not be a surprise. Senator Kennedy, he's got a habit of running for office. He ran for the Senate three times before he won. He entered the 2003 governor's race and then withdrew when Bobby Jindal got in. He ran for attorney general and lost in 1991, and he won for state treasurer in 99, 03, 07, 11, 15. He's a guy who doesn't seem to shy away from putting his hat in the ring.
Oh, not at all. And as you said, he's obviously expressed interest before in running for governor and being governor. And when I interviewed him recently about this topic, he said he is indeed considering the race. But he also said he had no timeline for it and that he will not be pressured into making a decision based on who else enters the race or artificial timelines that other people set. So it's really unclear, you know, when we'll know. And since he has such high name recognition, and I mean, there are few people who are voters in the state who don't know who John Kennedy is at this point. So he can wait and drag this out for a while before he announces a decision, purely because he's going to have the ability to fundraise. And, you know, he's going to have this name ID that everybody knows. So we may not know John Kennedy's decision for quite a while, I think.
But I would think as long as he's on the fence, he blocks other Republicans from getting in, with the possible exception of Ralph Abraham, who also looks like he may be testing the waters.
It is clear that people are trying to, that Republican candidates are trying to size up who else might be in or out, because obviously that could cut into somebody's natural base of support if somebody else gets in the race, or it could hamper their ability for fundraising. If someone is less known, like Senator Hewitt, for example, who's fairly new on the political scene, she's going to have to calculate, can she fundraise if somebody like John Kennedy is in the race with very high name ID and with a lot of built-in donor support. So clearly they're sizing up the field, and that's part of the problem in terms of people announcing is that you see them waiting to see what other folks are going to do.
Well, we thank both of you for joining us today, Kevin Fry from WAFB and Melinda DeLotte from the Associated Press. And we'll see you soon, I hope.
Thanks, Jim.
Take care.
Good luck covering what could be a chaotic session and almost likely to be a special session at some point, either now or later. Kevin, see you later. Kevin saunters from the studio and goes to the Capitol to see what's going on. We're joined now by Frances Moore LePay. She is a researcher and writer, a legendary activist of sorts, the author of 19 books, including the 3 million copy 1971 Diet for a Small Planet, when she was very young. It is described by the Smithsonian as one of the most influential political tracts of our time. Her latest work is Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. And good morning to you, Frances Moore LePay.
Thank you, Jim.
It's good to talk with you. You believe our democracy is in peril. How so?
I do, because I believe democracy is voice for all of us, each of us, equal voice. That's the essence of democracy. And I think more and more we feel shut out. The majority of us, 85% of us, believe that we need fundamental change in how we fund elections. And I think that reflects this idea that money is speaking, not you and me. So this exciting book that I wrote with a millennial, it's definitely a co-generational book. We tell the good news. Democracy's in trouble, yes, but there is a democracy movement that is arising, and it's really the first in my life, and I'm terribly excited about it.
There was a concern when the Citizens United decision was rendered by the Supreme Court that Republican candidates, principally for the highest office, president, would have a distinct money-raising advantage over Democratic candidates. But to this point, that concern has been allayed to a large extent. Hillary Clinton, for example, actually spent more money, considerably more, than did Donald Trump running for office in 2016. But does that take away the concerns you're expressing about the overall situation we're in right now?
Not to us, because actually the march of big money, big money, big money is continuing, and that determines, you know, who can even run for office in many ways. For example, in the last election, 2016, $6.4 billion were spent, but two-thirds of that was by about half of 1% of Americans were funding this. And as far as Hillary versus Donald Trump, I think that clearly he had a huge advantage because of his visibility as a media personality, and so there was a lot of free advertising counted in the billions there.
We'll return with Frances Moore LePay. Her book is Daring Democracy, and your number is 877-217-5757. This is Talk Louisiana, and we're back after this two-minute pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Sasha Gabonchon is producing, and our guest is Frances Moore LePay, a legendary activist who wrote one of the most talked-about books of her time, Diet for a Small Planet, in 1971. She says democracy is in peril and has been under siege for about five decades in our country. Her latest work with Adam Eichen, a millennial, is Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. And this situation you were referring to before we paused regarding the 2016 presidential election, you said $6.4 billion was spent. and fewer than 1% of the people in our country contributed? Is that the...
Contributed two-thirds of that gigantic number, yeah. So it was very weighted toward a handful of very wealthy people. And, Jim, I want to throw in something relevant to your state, exciting to me about solutions, and that is on February 2nd to the 4th in New Orleans is the first ever Unrig the System Summit. And anybody who wants to go, it's just unrigsummit.org. And it's about 1,000 people are coming, diving into solutions to our democracy situation.
That's February 2nd through the 4th in New Orleans. So
exactly.
And only 56% of the people voted in the presidential election of 2016, despite all the attention toward Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Why are we not voting in larger numbers?
Well, I think that a lot of us just feel that our votes don't count. And some of that can be attributed to, I'm sure you've heard the term gerrymandering. It's an old-fashioned term from my state of Massachusetts, but it just means that districts have been rigged in such a way that the majority is not heard, and now it's going to the Supreme Court because of a case out of Wisconsin. But I think there are a number of barriers. One of them is just there have been numerous states that have introduced photo ID requirements, for example, that make it hard for people who, for whatever reason, don't have a photo ID and have to take the time out of their busy, busy lives, often poor people who are really strapped for time and transportation, to get the required IDs. There are a number of barriers that have been put in place to make voting more difficult, in addition to this sense that, well, it really doesn't matter because those people with the money are going to end up having the power. Because I think a lot of people appreciate that lobbyists, for example, in the last 30, 40 years, the number of firms with lobbyists has increased something like 14-fold, you know, and the amount of money spent by the powerful interest to override what the citizens want. A good example is, why do we have such high pharmaceutical prices, you know, much higher than other countries that are industrial countries like ours? And I think one of the reasons is the power of lobbying, the power of private wealth over our political system. I think that turns people off because they feel like, what's the point? It's, the system is not working for me. And that's why this democracy movement, it really is a movement of movements, you know, of people coming from labor, coming from environment, coming from all issues, racial justice, et cetera, coming together under one large canopy of hope, is how I think of it, and saying democracy is the root, is the mother of all issues, in the sense we've got to come together to make sure that our voices are heard, not just the voices of those with wealth.
You look back to Newt Gingrich in 1995 with his contract with America to understand the deepening animus between the parties and a shift from engagement around policy to war over ideologies. Why do you believe that Speaker Gingrich, the graduate of Tulane University, was a chief culprit in this animus that we have on Capitol Hill and really across the country right now?
Well, I see him as a player. Certainly no one is singly responsible, but a real shift toward an attempt to make government less functional, to delegitimize. In other words, these were people who fundamentally didn't believe in the public sphere where we all had equal voice. That is my view. And he wrote, actually, he gave a speech, where he said that politics is really like war. It has to be fought at the scale and duration and savagery of civil war. And the ideology at the time of people who were along with him in this mindset was that the goal was not to come up with a decision by negotiating with an honorable opponent. It was to destroy the enemy's fighting power. The metaphor was war, and in his case, he used the term civil war. So that was a very disturbing understanding and that I got in the research of writing Daring Democracy with Adam Eichen, because I realized that it's not that these are bad people. We are not saying that. It's just that they have held a worldview which I don't think is consistent with democracy, because democracy is all about making government work for all of us, and that means negotiating across the table always and treating your opponent as somebody who also is respectable and not just to be ground to the ground, so to speak. Does that make sense?
Well, I think you're making a good point. Francis Moore LePay is with us for a few minutes longer. If you'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757. Her latest work is Daring Democracy. And you say that America is not as divided on either the causes or the cures for the democracy's problems, as many suggest. This comes despite the fact that you're saying democracy has been under siege since at least 1971. Why are we not as divided as it appears?
Well, I certainly think we're told that we're divided all the time. But I think that it's so important to realize how much common ground. I cited that 85% recently in this interview. I said that 85% of us agreed that money, we have to fundamentally change how we fund elections. Over 80% of us agree that wealth has too much power in our political system. About 70% of us agree that public financing, like we describe in Maine, where waitresses and others can run for office because they can get support from the public funds to run for office, so they don't have to rely on wealthy individuals, and they can succeed. And in Maine, for example, they have the largest percentage of working class people in the legislature. So there are solutions. And so these are all things, these views and these approaches are all supported by the majority of Americans. It's just that we don't know that it's possible. I guess that's a big part of our reason for being with Daring Democracy, is to get the word out that there are solutions that are working. In Seattle, for example, they came up with a brilliant idea of giving every citizen four vouchers of $25 each that they can then assign to the city council candidate of their choice. And a lot of people got involved and used those, and people who'd never really been engaged mm-hmm. before. And so there are a lot of ways to fix our democracy, and it is foundational to addressing our crisis of poverty, our crisis in the environment, in safe water, for example, all of these things.
Francis, you say that Donald Trump, it's certainly a fact, became the second president in the last five elections to lose the vote and win the election. So what can or should be done about the Electoral College?
Well, fortunately, there's a workaround that we don't have to wait to change the Constitution, which is a very long process. There's a workaround that now 11 states have gone along with, have bought into, giving us a real shot at this solution. The simple solution is getting enough states to commit that they will assign their electoral votes whoever wins the popular vote nationally. And as soon as we get enough states that commit to that, then it would go into effect. And so regardless of this challenge of having, the electoral vote set up as it is, it would correct the problem, because the popular vote would be the decisive vote, which makes sense to me in a democracy.
The president says that the election would have been much different had the popular vote been the determinant on who won. Does he have a point in that the election would have been run, the campaign would have been run much differently?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of things would have, would have changed. But I think the foundational point is that democracy depends on the deciders being the voters. And I think once we come to grips with that, that will just encourage more people to participate, to follow the issues, and directly engage with each other. And I think we'd do a much better job as citizens.
Well, the book is Daring Democracy, from Francis Moore LePay, a legendary figure in activism. And she is still going strong. And come just a few weeks from now, there will be a major summit in New Orleans. You say February 2nd through the 4th in the great city of New Orleans, there will be a democracy summit.
And I will be there.
Well, that's even better. So, Francis, it's a pleasure to spend time with you today. We appreciate your commitment to making our world a better place, and congratulations on another fine book, Daring Democracy, from Frances Moore LePay, with Adam Eichen, a millennial who collaborated
Indeed.
With her.
Thank you for your great questions. I loved it. Thank you.
Our pleasure. Thank you. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Sasha Gabashaw, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.